Hey, everybody. This is another episode of the Welcome To podcast. I'm your host, Zach Vega. Welcome To is brought to you by the Land Information Access Association. We're a nonprofit based out of beautiful Traverse City, Michigan, specializing in projects that help communities to improve on their sustainability. And we've been working around the state since 1993. If you want to follow the Welcome To podcast, follow us on iTunes, Spotify, or however you listen to your podcasts. And be sure to check us out at liaa.org. Today's episode is with Dr. Mark Wilson, who is a professor in Michigan State University's School of Planning, Design, and Construction. This is a great guest for a couple of reasons. First of all, Mark is Australian, and we just don't have enough podcast episodes with Australian accents. So, I mean, if you don't get anything else out of this episode, at least you enjoy that part of it. Second, and probably more importantly for our listeners, is that Mark is really at the forefront of trying to understand how autonomous vehicles are going to change society and the way that we live our lives, and especially how those changes to our lives affect the way that we develop our built environment. And there's a lot of question marks about how autonomous vehicles are going to affect us. And it's great to sit down with people like Mark who are going through all of the scenarios and imagining the good futures and the bad futures. And I hope you guys enjoy this episode, and I hope it raises some questions in your communities, and that you start thinking about, you know, in the same way that we thought about climate change and retail in the age of the internet, we need to plan for these things, and autonomous vehicles are no different. And I hope that this conversation that we have with Mark today helps you start to think about those things. So enjoy. All right, Mark, let's talk autonomous vehicles. Okay. Something that a lot of people are interested in, but we don't really know what they are, and I'm in that camp. I would say I'm not on the forefront of learning about this. So what is the new consensus of how autonomous vehicles are going to change the way that we drive?
Okay, that's a big question. First, to give a little background about what autonomous vehicles are.
Yeah.
And there are multiple levels of autonomy in vehicles. And many vehicles have those elements now. So they have things like cruise control and maintaining your position in a lane, collision avoidance, easy parking. So all of those elements are slowly infiltrating automobiles. And the goal is that the ultimate result will be a vehicle that can be directed to a particular place, and it will find its own way, and it will take you there safely. Now, at the moment, the autonomous vehicles on the road are at different levels. So there's level zero, which is driver in complete control, up to level five, where the driver plays no role whatsoever. And in the testing area, there are level fives, but the ones you tend to see on the road are much more likely to be around levels three and four, that can do autonomy, but also need driver intervention.
Right.
And this is a difficult time for that process, because it's easy to be lulled into thinking that the car is in charge when it's not. And so it is a difficult stage of development, because the driver does need to be paying attention. And it can be quite difficult if you're a passenger in a vehicle and it's making its own way and it's behaving well, yet you're expected within a second or two to leap in if something goes wrong, is very difficult.
Right.
So at the moment, they're almost there, but not quite there in terms of what we see on the road. In what's being tested, there are certainly cases of autonomous vehicles. So the rollout is expected to be soon, to be imminent. But there are a lot of decisions that have to be made about how the vehicles are used. And in looking at autonomous vehicles, I think what is often forgotten is the social context of the vehicle. The people working on the vehicles are working on them to make sure they do everything they should, which is stop and start, avoid collisions, not put passengers in danger. And so on the technical side, there's a vast focus on the success of the autonomous systems. On the social side, there's very little that's being done. So we did a study and we found that there were over 100,000 academic articles on how you build an autonomous vehicle. And there were fewer than 200 articles on how you make a city for autonomous vehicles. So clearly there's an imbalance here.
Planners being left out again.
Yeah, indeed, yes, yes. And I think part of it is because the technology was advancing away from the public gaze. This has been happening for a long time. Autonomy has been mooted for decades and has been slowly worked on.
Well, and it's also like social media and other technologies that come out where we become so interested and fascinated by the technology that we're not really – maybe it's not we're not interested, but we're not as quick to think about how it's going to affect us.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think it's that social side that is coming as a surprise. One of the elements that is still in flux is insurance. What is the state of insurance? In an autonomous vehicle, if something goes wrong, who's responsible?
Yeah, is it the company? Is it the driver?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, in cases where the driver is supposed to be on top of things, then it is the driver.
But you said it was autonomous. Yeah, that's why I bought it.
Exactly. And so there are a lot of gray areas. And until we know how much insurance will cost for these vehicles, it's hard to then start putting business models together. So we're at the stage we're at with the internet. I see a lot of parallels with the internet. In the 80s, the internet just burst onto the scene. A lot of effort and preoccupation was on how it worked, how we deliver signals, how computers communicate with each other. But we weren't thinking of the social implications. And now we're in an era where we look to the internet for urban planning issues. And several stages removed, the internet is the reason malls are closing. And we have a fifth of malls due to close in the next 5 to 10 years because of online shopping, which is an internet byproduct. And so I think that's an example that I often see parallels with autonomous vehicles. They've suddenly arrived. And we're not ready for them. We have not really thought about how our communities can change, what's going to be good, what's going to be bad. We can suggest things, but planners have had 2 or 3 years to think about autonomous vehicles, and the industry making them has had decades to think about it.
So what are some of the implications that, for example, I know one of them is, and I heard this at the APA conference a couple years ago in New Orleans, was the idea that you probably don't want to be building too many parking garages that can't be retrofitted into maybe an apartment complex down the road.
There's a lot of possibilities. And I use the metaphor of Schrodinger's cat when it comes to autonomous vehicles. And that was a thought experiment of you lock a cat in a box with poison, and it is both good and bad until you see the outcome. And so I can develop scenarios for you that are both good and bad. We just don't know. The thought experiment is that things are good and they are bad, and I can give you a scenario for each. But there is not one that has to happen.
Right.
Both could happen. We could have neighboring towns, and one has the positives and one has the negatives.
Yeah, especially the one that I think about a lot is traffic congestion, because one would think that if we don't have – I would think that it would increase traffic congestion, because if it's so easy to get around by just ordering a vehicle, it comes and picks you up and takes you to the next location where you're trying to go, like Uber, but without a driver, it seems like that would – actually promote more traffic.
And that's one of the scenarios. So and you talked about parking earlier to return to that too. So one scenario is we have the Uber model, which could be good because it could take vehicles off the road. Certainly it could free up parking spaces and free up a lot of parking spaces. So we have the example of Lansing. It was the crater city of 2018.
Yeah.
The aerial photographs, just nothing but surface parking lots. That all becomes freed up for development.
Right.
Which can provide greater density, mixed use, a lot of positives.
And to quantify that, I remember seeing a statistic that I think it was like 30% of Los Angeles' parking lot right now.
Yeah. And that suddenly becomes freed up for other things. That's a real plus. But that's if we share vehicles, we use the Uber model, and they don't need to park. They're constantly in motion. The trouble is that if people won't follow that Uber model, they will follow, I want to own my own. Mm-hmm. Then you've got a lot of congestion.
Yes.
Then you have a peaking problem, an institution like MSU that finishes at 5 for the faculty and staff. You have thousands of people summoning vehicles. If you have a surge pricing model, then people are not going to be happy.
No, it's going to be $40 to get home.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So there's this one scenario. Talking on the negatives, we have positives in a moment. But you also have the fact that if driving is less of a hassle, are you willing to live further away? So if you get in your car and you watch a movie or you open your laptop and start working and you're on the clock, you might be happy to be an hour from work instead of a half hour, simply because it's so much more pleasant.
Right.
And in which case, we have a push for sprawl. Mm-hmm. Greater distances involved rather than providing a denser, more closely knit community model. So we have all these nightmare scenarios of more vehicles, more miles driven. One of the fears is that autonomous vehicles will really hurt public transit. And the Uber has already shown this in cities like New York, where Uber is stealing people from the subway. Mm-hmm. Subway is incredibly efficient. It's underground. A lot of environmental benefits, but people are using Uber rather than the subway. Well, autonomous vehicles could draw on that as well. And so it could take people away from public transit. And what about buses? There is a lot of promotion of autonomous buses, but how many people late at night are going to get in a bus without a driver to mediate safety?
And why would you want to be on a fixed route when you can just go straight to where you want to be?
Yeah, exactly. So does this have a big negative impact on public transit, which can be very efficient, yet it may be damaged by autonomous vehicles and how we use them?
Have you seen, I'm sure you have, but have there been any developments of the idea of, I wish we could draw for the audience, but those, it's sort of autonomous boxes of passenger public transportation, and then they can separate, though, and go off into different directions.
And I think these are all looking at different models. The trouble is concern over safety, because you have, when you have drivers, you have someone to mediate, to report as an authority figure. Otherwise, you're essentially getting in a moving cage with people you don't know. And are you going to feel comfortable doing that, or will you choose an alternate form of transportation?
Right.
So there are some negatives that have to be addressed, but these are all on the social side. And the argument of planners is that we understand the engineering very well. We don't understand how people will behave. And it's only recently that we've started engaging with psychologists and sociologists as planners to see how people will live their lives in an AV environment.
How are they testing that?
It's very difficult to test. And part of it is that you provide a community with free Ubers for a week and see how people change their behavior, how they interact. You can do mock-ups and see how people will interact. But it's very difficult until we open the box and see what's inside and what's happened. Then there's an alternative, and this is the positive side, is it could provide, if it does cut the amount of traffic, it does cut the miles traveled. If we do take those more parking lots and provide for a denser corridor that is better for public transit, then we do have wider sidewalks and narrower streets. We do have parking lots that are being used for other purposes. One project I'm working on now is the future of the garage. Mm. 79 million garages in the U.S. What happens to them if you don't need them for a vehicle?
A lot of man caves.
Exactly, and she sheds. And we've also looked at, in some areas, alternate housing options. If you have 400 or 500 square feet in a garage, do you make it a small apartment? Will local planners accept that? Will the community accept every garage on a suburban street being turned into a small apartment? In some communities that have housing problems, that's a real asset. Other communities will never accept it. But the question remains, what happens? Will it be possible to build a house without a garage and a driveway going forward? Looking at a scenario of 20 or 30 years when you will just get picked up at your house or nearby, do we need the same type of land use guidelines and building codes when we don't need garages? Those are all social issues that need to be addressed through the social and political and planning process. They can't be answered by the technology. The problem is for planners, those things don't get resolved instantly. You can't go into a lab and run different scenarios and say, this is optimal.
Because you just can't predict human behavior. Yep. It's impossible.
You need to engage with the public. One of my fears and one of my hopes is that this will cause people to come together around the future of their community. This will be such a big deal that they will come out.
You're so optimistic, Mark.
Yeah, I am optimistic. But the nightmare scenario is that there won't be any conversation. It will move forward randomly. Different communities with different standards. Some places will make decisions that will bring benefits, and others will not make decisions that will leverage the benefits and diminish the costs.
Yeah, and I think whenever I think about the big changes that are happening in planning, and this is probably, when I think about them, the biggest one that's potentially going to be happening very soon, is the idea that there's a lot of communities that don't have the technical capacity to actually be thinking about these things. So do you think that these regulations or changes to the built environment, they're going to have to come from state initiatives or a federal policy? Or how do you...
The feds and the state both play a role in laying the landscape for this, as it were. The trouble is planning is always local.
Right.
And what happens is that planners will get a shock. Things will turn up. And we've already experienced this recently with e-scooters.
Yeah.
They have turned up, and suddenly you come to work Monday morning as a planner, and there are e-scooters all over your town, and you have no policy, and you have no strategy, and suddenly you're being asked to make a decision about how they'll be used and where they can be used and who has control over their use. And this becomes a shock in the system, and suddenly there is a scramble. And I think it's very difficult to get ahead of some of the technologies simply because they are just turning up before we're fully aware, in the same way that the internet affected many communities before they were fully aware of what the implications were.
How many years are we away from seeing fully autonomous vehicles?
Well, the industry keeps promising next year, and it's been next year for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. But I think we're getting closer and closer. Certainly, the industry is moving very quickly on one front, which is electric vehicles, which is what you prefer with an autonomous vehicle. It's safer and easier to manage an electric vehicle than a gas-powered vehicle. And so huge advances in that regard. But I still think that the challenges are going to be social acceptance. Only about a third of the population, when you do surveys, is eager to jump in one.
It's pretty consistent with every new idea.
Yeah. And so that means you've still got a lot of people who are doubting. Right. And so on one hand, we have public reticence. On the other hand, we have planners who have more than autonomous vehicles to think about.
Yeah.
One of the lessons for planning is this is not an AV issue. It is a mobility issue. And the solution to your town's mobility problem may not be AVs. It may be better public transit. It may be more walking. It may be bike paths. But to focus solely on the technology misses the issue, and that is people need to move. How do they move? And the solution to your community's mobility needs may not be an AV. It may be part of the solution, but it's not the whole thing. You have to see this more broadly. So on top of this mobility issue we're dealing with at the moment, planners also have two other elements of the perfect storm. One is going to be the change in Main Street and retailing, which will take away tax bases and community centers in terms of recognizing the mall as part of the commercial hub of a community. And the other is going to be renewable energy, where we move to local production of solar or per household use of solar. So planners are not simply dealing with one thing at a time. They're dealing with a whole package of technology-based changes. So mobility technology, retailing technology, and energy technology are all in flux and all changing. And that makes it very difficult to predict exactly where communities can go, because there's a steep learning curve for planners and residents at the moment, just in terms of what these things will bring for their communities.
And I think the question that I always think of when I think of autonomous vehicles is, obviously, we're not going to have everybody in an autonomous vehicle mm-hmm. at the same time. Mm-hmm. How have they done any research on how, if there's a street with 50 vehicles mm-hmm. on it, if 12 of them are autonomous and the rest are not?
That's the difficult outcome. Often the scenario is no autonomous vehicles and all autonomous vehicles. And when you see the all autonomous scenarios, they're really quite amazing, because you don't have traffic lights anymore.
Right, because everything's communicating with it.
Yeah, and so it works beautifully. Mm-hmm. But what about 40 years of sharing the road? Because there's a lot of cues you use when driving that autonomous vehicles don't have. So there's eye contact, there's waving someone through a yield sign to let them in. There's a lot of things that happen that AVs don't react to.
Right.
And AVs can be bullied. You can go closer to it and keep stopping it. You can walk in front of it.
That's what I was also going to ask, that, because I don't know why I always have this as such a morbid example, mm-hmm. but it is my example mm-hmm. of, what if two people are trying mm-hmm. to kill me mm-hmm. and I get into my autonomous vehicle, mm-hmm. one person stands at the rear of the car, mm-hmm. one person stands at the front. How do I get away?
Exactly. And there are multiple scenarios. There was a case of the police last year. Someone was driving while drunk, and they passed out mm-hmm. in a Tesla, which has a high level of autonomy.
It's probably the safest place to ever do that.
Yeah, it's true. But the
Not
vehicle
advisable.
Was moving forward, yeah. And how did the police stop it? So they surrounded it and slowed down until it stopped. But it brings up issues of who has the switch to turn on and off these systems, if you had to, right. How do you stop an escaping vehicle? How do you get access to it to stop it moving?
And that also brings up an ethical question of, should we allow third parties to stop our vehicles?
Exactly. And it also raises the question, who makes the decision and how and when? Ugh. And again, the issues are not so much with the technology. They are all around the social context of
right.
that technology. And so it's legal issues, political issues, privacy. All of these are bundled together in the mobility decision. And the trouble with that is that we haven't really had a lot of good testing
yeah.
that lets us make decisions about how people will behave or react.
I wanted to get your opinion on the ethical question of, because there's, I don't even know how many car accidents mm-hmm. there are mm-hmm. every year, but obviously thousands
sure. yeah.
of people mm-hmm. die every year from car accidents, but that's not really talked about because it's so commonplace. Mm-hmm. But any time that there's one autonomous vehicle accident and someone's injured, it's all over the news. So it's kind of that question of, it seems that a lot of people are probably more okay with there being a higher level of accidents mm. as long as it's a human error mm. as opposed to one accident that's technology error-based.
I think it's exactly right. The issue with any AV accident at the moment, it is far more newsworthy mm-hmm. than yet another highway fatality. And so the newsworthiness of it drives it. It also feeds into fears about the technology. But several deaths, tragic, from AVs against 40 to 50,000 highway deaths that we have now is a matter of us coming to terms with risk and our understanding of risk. And it's very difficult to publicly discuss issues of risk because it's so emotional and the consequences are so great. And so one of those conversations we will need to have is about this transition. At the moment, it is more sensationalism because, especially when there was one pedestrian death there from an AV versus many pedestrian deaths that are not AV-based that do not get the same level of scrutiny or discussion. So I think this is going to be another element of our adaptation, our understanding of what's acceptable and how to determine what's acceptable in our society in terms of accidents and issues that arise associated with autonomous vehicles.
Yeah. As we're just talking, I'm mm-hmm. thinking of so many scenarios, mm-hmm. especially like in Michigan where we have so much wildlife mm-hmm. in our backyards. Mm-hmm. And as a 16-year-old, my mom and I'm sure a lot of people my age, their parents always tell you if there's a deer that runs out mm-hmm. and you've got someone behind you, it's better to go through and hit that deer mm-hmm. than to slam on the brakes and cause an accident. Mm-hmm. So, but how does an autonomous vehicle say, oh, that's a deer. It's better to hit that deer than to slam on the brakes.
And hopefully the vehicle behind, if it's autonomous. Also knows. Yeah. One of the all autonomous futures, which is great, is the vehicle behind will be told that you're braking suddenly mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. will brake suddenly. But that's 20 years into the future. At the moment, do these vehicles sense better? Will there be fewer animal injuries because they're better sensed, especially when you're driving at night in Michigan? You often don't see anything until the last minute,
right.
Whereas sensors may well, in fact, detect that movement earlier.
A heat sensor or something.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's a lot of testing done on how to recognize what is moving around a vehicle. And that testing is fortunately being able to be done without injuring people, because you can use mock-up situations of trying all different scenarios, different times of light, different conditions, with rain, without rain. You can do that in the lab and make a lot of progress. But until it's out on a wet night in Michigan with wet leaves and difficulty detecting what's happening, that makes it hard to see the autonomous decision-making actually working.
So I'm sure the automobile industries are doing a lot of this research. Who else is looking into this?
It's an interesting split, and especially for Michigan, one of the interests is going to be, where does the auto industry go? Mm. At the moment, we have a well-established, successful industry that makes vehicles. It makes a certain type of vehicle. Those vehicles are changing dramatically in that they will require a vast amount of software. And that part of the industry is partially in Michigan. It's partially in California, in Silicon Valley. So I'm wondering if we're seeing the industry split more with the software side in California and the vehicle side and some software in Michigan. Now, certainly the auto industry has bought a lot of software startups to capture intelligence, experience, and intellectual property. And so the auto industry is certainly having a heavy presence in Silicon Valley, simply because it owns or has established its own companies that are working on the software side of the auto industry. But what happens going forward? Where does control lie? Will it remain as a two-region industry divided between the Midwest and going down to like Kentucky and Tennessee, where the auto industry is concentrated with software in California, or is at some stage it going to end up in one place? There is a great opportunity for Michigan, but also a great threat to Michigan as to where that industry will go and how it will unfold, because many of the software players have vast resources to enable them to also invest in the auto industry mm-hmm. rather than the auto industry invest in the software side.
Well, that's kind of why it's difficult to buy a Tesla in Michigan right now, right? It's because they're trying to maintain that separation.
Yes, yeah. But the other thing to think about is the auto industry is interested in its survivability and its future.
Yeah.
And so it's looking at what the vehicle will become. And they've made the decision that electric is in the future, in part helped by standards, especially in Europe, around electric vehicles becoming the norm. And so it's moving away from internal combustion to electricity. So that is a change that's happening. But there are also other changes. What happens when vehicles become fleet purchases rather than personally owned? Mm-hmm. What then happens to the makeup of the industry, how it functions? And there's also looking at other connections between media and vehicles. So now you can have things like Siri and Alexa as part of your vehicle. Mm-hmm. And they can be built in elements to your vehicle. So we're seeing the vehicle also become a housing for a lot of media systems that then get connected to it. So the vehicle, in fact, becomes a gigantic roaming iPhone because it now has a lot of that connectivity and a lot of the services that originally were seen separately, but in fact now being built into the automobile.
Oh, it's so much. One of the things that I was wondering in terms of when you're talking about the model of the automobile industry in the future is, I don't think you can talk to a parent of a young person today who doesn't say, I can't believe they don't want to get their driver's license. They're fine with Ubering everywhere. And when you look at streaming services like Spotify and iTunes, where people don't really buy music anymore, they stream it. And I've heard a couple of interesting ideas where people won't own a car, they'll pay a monthly premium, and then if they're going into the city, they'll get a sedan that shows up. If they're going into the mountains, they might get a larger vehicle. Do you see much merit to that, where people won't want to buy cars anymore?
Yeah,
they just want to...
Well, I think urban planners have often had a love-hate relationship with vehicles.
Yeah, that's definitely
because
true.
Because they provide mobility. The trouble is the dominant mobility determines the planned landscape. And so with automobiles, we got suburbia.
Mm-hmm.
And the trouble with suburbia is it's very hard to serve with anything but automobiles because the density doesn't support a lot of public transit. So our choices about the future of the vehicle will, in fact, make decisions about the future of how our communities look, especially if that is also connected to things like sustainability and the changing retail landscape. So all of this gets packaged together. But I can see a very different future coming out because of it. What that future is not quite clear yet.
What do you think it's going to be?
Well, as I said, I have dreams and nightmares. Yeah. You know, my nightmares are that we have more sprawl, more congestion. There will be more and more people using AVs for shorter distances. The distances used.
Yeah, we just stop walking.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that has health implications.
Yeah.
Now, on the positive side, there are certainly many groups who will benefit. Older residents will regain mobility after they stop driving.
People without personal vehicle ownership.
Yeah, there's a lot of possibilities there. There's also possibilities around more efficient use of road space, the remaking of parking lots into other land uses that are more productive. And so it can go both ways, and I see a spectrum. And some places will demonstrate all the worst elements, as we've seen in our cities today. Some illustrate the worst outcomes of long strips of partially used retail centers with a lot of congestion and traffic. But we may also see some greater density, which isn't always popular, but density brings benefits and value as well. We also see communities that have carefully thought through their planning process and do not suffer so much from those wasted commercial spaces or demand a very heavy energy use in order to live in that location.
The thing that worries me is that it seems like that in terms of communities doing their planning, it seems from what I've seen that there's some that are very proactive, some that are very they're not looking at their master plan at all. They haven't updated it in 20 years. And then there's a lot in the middle. It seems like if we just introduce this new idea into the market without any prior training to communities or any guidance, that it's just going to be very
unpredictable. I've raised that point on two levels. One is getting into all of these technologically assisted vehicles, especially if you're not used to them, can be very frustrating. So you rent a car that comes loaded with a lot of these new technologies, as I have done, it's like, what do I do? I really need a crash course in how all of these systems work because I've not encountered them. So we have the personal lack of familiarity. And then we have, at the other end, we have the community lack of experience and familiarity. And the reason it's there is that we haven't had them in our community yet. I don't think that many people have actually seen an autonomous vehicle in their community, let alone thinking about what dozens of them would mean. Mm-hmm. That said, I can't think of a better time for communities to revisit their master plan, because they're not just revisiting it for mobility, they're revisiting it for changes in the commercial landscape, and they're revisiting it in terms of climate change and energy generation.
Yep.
So much is happening now that really demands communities sit down and go through the process of discussing what their future vision is. Is there a vision? Is there an expectation of where we would like our community to go and what it would look like? It's a time-consuming process. And not every community takes the time to sit down, because it is frustrating, it is messy, to sit down with dozens, if not hundreds of people and talk about how you want your community to look in the future. But that's what we need to do. Part of that also requires education. Mm-hmm. One issue I've raised is, who is responsible for educating the public about autonomous vehicles?
Well, you are, Mark.
That's true. And this podcast is one step in the right direction. But it's also, at the moment, the industry has vast resources to spend on informing us about autonomous vehicles.
Yeah, but why would they care?
Because they want us to buy it.
Well,
or to at least see them as positive.
I mean, in terms of the master planning process, mm-hmm. preparing for having
for the master plan, that is
the social impacts. Yeah, I mean, the technology. Yeah. I could totally see them informing you on how the technology works, but I don't.
Well, no, that's it. There aren't the resources there on the community side. So we have a very asymmetrical, unbalanced resource situation at the moment. Of those with vested interests in autonomous vehicles as the future have resources to advertise and promote their point of view and their direction. And there's certainly a lot of overlap. There's certainly many benefits that could come from AVs in the future. But at the same time, where do the resources come for communities to learn about it? Who is providing their input? Who is promoting their community agenda?
Yeah.
There's not the resources or even the expertise at the moment. The expertise is slowly growing, but it's still, we're a long way behind the engineering side. So my concern for planning is that it has had this new thing arrive on its doorstep, and at the same time, it has to gear up and prepare. Where do the resources come from? Who pays for the extra time for the community messaging around future scenarios? That is all something that at the moment is not really happening.
Yeah, the scenario, because we do scenario-based mm-hmm. planning for our coastal mm-hmm. work to show people, if you build housing here, this is the floodplain, and mm-hmm. This is how much mm-hmm. property will be affected mm-hmm. by that. And that's fairly easy to quantify mm-hmm. But we've still got communities across the state who are building in, you know, the water goes out for 15 mm-hmm. years and then they build on the beach and then mm-hmm. it comes back in and they're all flooded. So even that educational component, we're still getting out there. Mm-hmm. And then you've got other things like local food mm-hmm. systems. And it just seems like technology has completely upended. I think it's put a lot more responsibility on planners to be an education resource as opposed to just a facilitator yeah. resource.
Yeah. And I think that many communities have been blindsided in the past by technological change. Certainly things like e-scooters turn up unannounced yeah. and you've got to deal with it.
And the retail too.
Yeah, and retail is hitting many communities quite heavily, and it is advancing very quickly. Mm-hmm. Even in this area, the malls are shadows of their former selves in terms of the activity and the products.
The social context yeah. of it has changed.
Yeah. And so for many years, we have seen the mall as being the center of our suburban communities. What happens when it no longer plays that function? We need to use them for something else. How do we plan for that? So I think there's a lot on the plate of the planner at the moment, at a time when we perhaps have disinvested in many communities away from many public services and public functions that don't get the resources that they need in order to do their job well. Right. Because this takes time for people to learn. It takes time for communities to recognize their preferences and priorities. Who is paying for this? It has to be a local expense. So we almost have this mandate to accept transportation, and it really is a divided responsibility. because we have private vehicles with the history of the automobile requiring public expenditures on roads to cater to them. And so now we have a new type of vehicle, the autonomous vehicle. It may not be solely privately owned. It may, in fact, be a subscription service. But we then have the demands that the public provides the environment to serve this new form of mobility. And given the disinvestment in so much public infrastructure, are we going to be in a position to be able to do that as well going forward as we have been in the past?
Right. Well, I wonder if it would reinvigorate people's interest in spending money on infrastructure.
My hope is multiple levels. One of those is to investing in the infrastructure we need and the infrastructure we need for climate change, but also that people will have the conversation, that asking people, when was the last time you sat down with your neighbors and talked about how you wanted your neighborhood to look or where you wanted it to go? Because usually those decisions are made in an ad hoc basis around any new development that comes into town. It will rally different causes for and or against. And then that decision will be made out of context for one piece of land and how it gets used and changed in the future, rather than having a more vision-oriented approach that you would need for a new master plan. But that is not something you do overnight. The master plan process can take years if you do it with the appropriate consultation and education and discussion.
Right. So how, because there's, I don't, it's not a high percentage of people who know what autonomous vehicles are, even fewer, probably none, who know exactly how it's going to affect our built environment. So for planners right now, as this, you know, because we're oriented towards looking towards the future and wanting to find the best solution so that we're prepared for what's going forward, how do we help communities plan for this now?
I think the first stage of this, and this is our lesson from the introduction of the internet into Michigan. We studied and surveyed planners about their knowledge and their needs, and we created something called the ALERT model. And the ALERT model is A is awareness. And the first thing you have to remember is that remembering what you learned 5 or 10 years ago may no longer be valid. It may have been in the past, but today with the rate of change, you need to be very aware of what is happening in your community. The L is for layers, to understand the geographic implications. The E is the role of technology, the e-resources. The R is responsiveness. Are you in a community that responds to challenges and opportunities, or is it a community that tends to resist addressing change? And T is talking to everyone. And so I go back when people say what to do, awareness is the first thing. What is the current state of thinking about planning for autonomous vehicles? And planners are looking at this. There are reports. You will see sessions at conferences like APA and Michigan Association of Planning. But the first thing we need to do is make ourselves aware of what the implications are before we can even start having the conversation about where do we want to take this.
Right. So kind of a scenario-based planning approach of, okay, if it creates more congestion, what do we do?
Yep.
If it creates more sprawl, potentially more sprawl, what do we do? Mm. If it removes all the parking lots, what do we do? So you sort of imagine everything that can happen, like I'm sure you have, it keeps you up at night.
Yeah, but you can also use it to be directive, though, because you can usually say, if we want less sprawl, how do we structure autonomous vehicles?
Yes,
And you don't want the person responsible for autonomous vehicles in the city not talking to the person responsible for reusing mall parking lots.
Right.
This is a joint decision, and don't look at them separately. They're often bundled separately when you look at reports. They're often kept separate, but the planner's responsible for the whole community, and therefore they need to look at everything that's changing. And the problem with AVs is they're coming at a time when we're already swamped with other changes, climate change, energy production, and retail landscapes.
Right. Well, those have been huge.
Yeah, and then we're adding another one.
Yeah, that's what kind of, when I'm thinking about how we've thought about the different aspects of planning over the past decade or so, and it's sort of like, We've thought about retail because of the internet. We've thought about climate change because we've got places underwater. And the transportation has really been a fight for more public transit, which has, I would say, in most places, not really caught on because, you know, we're America. We like our car. We like to be the pioneer.
Especially Michigan.
We like to be the pioneers in our car and go forth and do great things. So it hasn't, I don't think it, from my perspective, the transportation emphasis hasn't been that
It hasn't arrived
resounding,
yet. What happens is we can see it coming. We can see it looming in the same way we could see the internet coming, but the internet's 25, 30 years old in commercial terms. It's 50 years old as a technology. And it took a while. That 15 years ago, we were not seeing the same implications for, say, retailing that we now have with next-day delivery and some places testing same-day delivery for online purchases. But that is going to change the landscape of what we use our land for. So we can see a little into the future on a lot of these technologies, but it means getting up to speed on what it could do. And my hope is that we harness it. We think this is what it could do. How do we shape it? How do we give a direction to it rather than letting it find its own path of least resistance?
Yeah, well, that's going to be hard to do.
Definitely.
It seems like it's going to be a lot of, like you've said, prepare for what we prepare for scenarios, but we, one, don't know which scenario it's going to be, and two, we might only be imagining 10% of the scenarios.
And also imagine the scenario you want and then see what it takes for you to get there.
Right.
Rather than just sit by and watch the changes take place, be proactive. So it is really a call to action by communities and planners to simply think about, well, how do you want to live in 10, 20 years' time? What does your town look like? How should it look? Are there changes you want to make? What would those changes be? And how do we get to those changes? And then what are the scenarios that we can lay out that may get us there?
And especially in the U.S., it seems like it would be fairly straightforward in Europe where they have really governmental control over how land is, how the landscape develops. It's very compact and pretty uniform. If you drive around France, it looks pretty much the same in every place you go. But in the U.S., we have such a difference in the different transects of New York City compared to rural Michigan, and the different implications that autonomous vehicles are going to have in those different places, not really knowing. Do you have any indication of how what it would look like in a rural community?
Yeah, well, it could be both liberating in a rural community in the way that you can give people mobility that may have been isolated. But to go back to your European example, I don't think Europe will be affected to the same extent because it is still dependent on public transit, and it has a layout. It has efficient public transit that will be harder to steal from. The U.S. tends to not have as robust a public transit sector in most cities. It's much easier to steal passengers from a system that runs every half hour than a system that runs every 4 minutes in a densely populated city in Europe or in Asia. So I think the U.S. is going to become one of the first places to see the significant effects because we are more likely to implement autonomous vehicles earlier and in greater numbers than other parts of the world because they play a much bigger role in our life here compared to other countries.
Right, and we've got the technology.
And it's invented here and it's developed here. Though European car makers are all working on autonomous vehicles, but the potential to implement that in a dense European city is not going to be as great as in the suburbia of the U.S.
That's interesting stuff. You got me worried now, Mark. optimistic and happy to be a planner. That's what we do.
We should be worried enough to act.
Yes.
But not worried enough to lose sleep at the moment. But it certainly should worry us enough to think about how we proceed, what we do next.
In terms of wanting to, if you're a public official somewhere and you want to start thinking about these things, who are you reaching out to for the information?
At the moment, there is not really one centralized place. Even the words that get used. If you look at the legislation across the U.S., there's automated, autonomous, self-driving, and driverless. And they all carry different significances. So there's not even a standard use of term. The federal government is commonly using automated. The urban planning literature uses autonomous. So we don't even know the words we're using yet on this. Right. And places are producing very different legislation at the state level. But when you reach out, there is beginning to be knowledge that the planning associations are mindful of this, like APA or the state level planning associations. For the last couple of years, have been offering conference sessions and presentations. Mm-hmm. But at the moment, it is a number of planners looking at what is coming, but there's no set standard that you can point to. In the same way you can point to climate records and floodplains and come forth with a fairly good estimate of where to build and not to build. We haven't reached that level of experience yet. At the moment, it is us thinking about what will happen next and trying to look at tests, pilot studies. How are people behaving around pilot studies? There's not that many of those published. There's only 5 or 6 studies of pilot AV uses for a corporation or a community, seeing what people think. So we're at the moment pretty much having to collect a lot of information before we can even suggest directions for communities.
It's overwhelming. All right. Well, we're about 50 minutes. And is there any other ideas about autonomous vehicles that you've come across? Because I know you've been working on this for a while now.
To me, they are fascinating because of their potential to completely change the way we live, in much the way that the internet has changed the way we live. We would not be doing this in a pre-internet era because the whole podcast was not the scale it is today. Right. So I think this is a time of great flux and change. And planners need to be mindful of what it means for how we live in the future. And we also need our communities to help us by providing thoughts and suggestions and preferences.
Well, being open to participating in how we're going to work towards solutions that these are going to introduce, as opposed to what we're seeing a lot of with the climate change stuff is, hey, we're flooding. Will you come help us figure out how to not continue flooding? What do we need to do? How do we zone for this? Yeah. The reactive part of it is, I mean, that's got to be what you see almost most of the time. And yeah, I think it's like educational institutions, the government, the federal government, people who are in the know of planning information. It seems like it's one of those things where you don't want to sound like the person who's crying wolf.
Of course. I think one thing that planning can bring to all this is that we do have tried and true methods of working with communities to find out what their preferences are.
Right, right. It's all interesting stuff. Well, thanks for talking about this stuff.
It's a pleasure. Really, I'm always happy to talk planning and autonomous vehicles.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
There. Welcome To is brought to you by the Land Information Access Association. For more information about what we do, go to liaa.org. Music for this podcast was provided by Blue Dot Sessions. Talk to you guys next time.